All right. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
And welcome to the monthly meeting of the District of Columbia Board of Ethics and Government Accountability. I'm Robert Stagnoletti, Chair of the Board. Choking on my own words here. It is October 6th, 2016. The time is 11 a.m. We are located at 1 Judiciary Square in room 540 South, and we have the entire board today, all four members, constituting a quorum. Welcome, everybody. We have kind of a moderately busy agenda today, so we'll just jump right on in. An agenda was posted consistent with the Open Meetings Act for everyone to see, and I personally do not have any amendments or additions or deletions from the agenda. If everyone else okay with the way it is?
Yes.
All right, so we'll adopt it by consensus. And we will turn to Ms. Hughes for a report on the Office of Open Government.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. On October 5th, OOG initiated its first enforcement action against a public body. The enforcement action is against Michael Yates in his capacity as chairman of the Mayor's Advisory Commission on Caribbean Community Affairs. This enforcement action is being taken as a result of the commission's willful disregard of the Open Meetings Act by failing to reply in full to the OOG's request for compliance, and in the absence of compliance, provide full details as to why the body did not abide by the OMA. The OOG made every attempt to resolve the matter outside the purview of the court by working with the mayor's office to get the body to come into compliance. Our efforts were not successful. As submitted to the board earlier this week, the OOG filed motion for temporary restraining order demanding that the public body refrain from holding any future meetings and to immediately publish all outstanding meeting minutes, notices, draft and final meeting agendas, and meeting recordings. We also filed a motion for a preliminary injunction and a complaint for declaratory and injunctive relief. So the first hearing on the TRO is scheduled for October 27th.
Is this in front of the judge in chambers, Superior Court?
Yes.
Okay. And who is going to actually handle the matter?
Well, for now, it's myself, unless the other party raises any opposition to that.
Right.
The difficulty is going to be is a good portion of these records are connected to my training of MACA prior to anyone else's arrival for this office.
Right.
But Mr. Barton is a trained litigator. I'm going to defer to him primarily for all of this. So,
Has there been any thought given to whether or not perhaps the Office of the Attorney General could be of some assistance in this?
Well, I don't know how they would be of assistance other than to help negotiate some type of settlement because Mr. Barton did some research, and we've got to serve the OOG or give them copy of the complaint. So it's my understanding they're in the position to defend.
Right. No, I understand. Right. I understand that, but in terms of helping to resolve the matter.
Oh, certainly.
Right.
So George Valentine in the Civil Litigation Unit at OAG
okay. Is
on all of the community email chains that we've been exchanging in the past few days about this matter. So he's aware that it's upcoming.
Okay, so I can foresee some potential issues with anyone from the office actually serving as the role of a lawyer when so many of the witnesses may be from the office as well. No, again, the statute permits you. You are the enforcement body and permits you to do this. It'll be kind of an interesting thing to see. And whether or not you might have to enlist the aid of somebody outside, even somebody on the pro bono side of things who's
right. Interested
in open government to help be the, at least, in-court lawyer while you and perhaps Mr. Barton as well serve as witnesses, depending on what the evidence, again, it's, I don't know what the evidence would look like, but again, I just throw that out there.
I completely agree. We discussed it, and we thought it's best just to get everything filed.
Right.
And then we'll duke it all over who does what.
Let's hope there's a resolution.
I hope so.
So, okay.
Mr. Barton, do you have anything to add? Did I miss anything? Okay.
Okay.
Are there any other questions?
It's both unfortunate, but unprecedented. All right, so we've had the Open Meetings Act long before you all existed. And it's the very first time it's being enforced in this manner.
It is.
After many, 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 many efforts by you and Mr. Barton in the office to try to resolve this and just get them into compliance. I mean, this is not asking them to do anything other than what the law requires. So it's unfortunate that we're at this point, and again, unprecedented, but it's an important part of what your responsibility is, so we appreciate you putting yourself out there like this.
Sure, we'll keep you posted. We'll see what happens. Training. Since the last board meeting on September 1st, the OOG has conducted one combined FOIA and Open Meetings Act training with the Criminal Code Reporting Commission, and Open Meetings Act training with the Board of Chiropractic, a FOIA training with the Office of Planning, and a combined OMA ethics training that was arranged by the Mayor's Office of Talent and Appointments. Public outreach. We met, Mr. Barton and I, with the Washington Legal Clinic, the staff of the Washington Legal Clinic, on September 12th. And the purpose of the meeting was to inform them about the Freedom of Information Act, the Open Meetings Act, and the role of our office and how we can assist them in their efforts. Thanks to Mr. Barton, who has a previous professional connection to the Washington Legal Clinic, the head of that legal clinic made it clear that she read that opinion that we issued to the Housing Authority. Mm-hmm. So they've had quite a few questions about that. So hopefully that will lead to more calls to our office for assistance. We also met, and I gave a short presentation to the D.C. Federation of Citizens on September 28th. There was significant interest in the office, and many of the Federation chairs in attendance said that they would like for us to come and speak to their respective citizen associations at a later date. The board will be interested to know that I met for the first time yesterday with the mayor's new open government officer, Elena Intrieri. Ms. Intrieri is formerly the special general counsel, I believe, or special counsel to Phil Mendelson. So we had a very productive meeting, and I think it's going to be fine. I just kind of laid out for her some of the existing landmines, made it clear that we've got Open Meetings Act well under control, but to the extent that she can focus her efforts on FOIA, because right. I've stayed out of that lane, I would appreciate it if they could just take a hard look at that from the central processing system on down.
Absolutely.
So well,
I'm just glad that you're communicating with them.
Of course,
because
yes.
That was I'm on their side.
Yes.
Yes. I always know you were willing
to. So we've agreed to work together and to collaborate. Sure. So there's nothing to indicate that it'll be anything different.
Awesome.
On October 8th, this Saturday, I'm going to be participating in the National Freedom of Information Conference. So I'll be participating in a panel discussion on Saturday afternoon. And you all have in those handy-dandy red folders a brochure that we have developed. So luckily, we've got communications and marketing experience in-house. So between WADA and myself and Johnny, WADA did the design layout, and we are going to be printing out that brochure, hopefully in time for the symposium. Okay.
That's great. Is that here in D.C.?
Yes, where our symposium.
Our symposium. But what about your the meeting you were just discussing?
Oh, no, for Saturday?
Yeah.
No, I can't do it because right now I don't know how I'm going to pay for it.
Okay.
But we can discuss that later. But
I see that on the horizon.
That's the brochure.
Right.
Okay. Advice. OOG continues to experience an increase in requests for advice. Since September 1st, we have fielded between Mr. Barton and myself 30 requests for advice on FOIA and the Open Meetings Act. We received one request for a formal advisory opinion on FOIA, and that pertained to a request submitted to the Office of the Mayor. I worked with the Mayor's Office of General Counsel and an attorney assisting Ms. Intrieri to facilitate processing of that request rather than issuing an opinion. The budget. As the board is aware, the Office of Open Government was not successful in its attempts to convince the Executive Office of the Mayor to provide OOG a separate budget for fiscal year 2017. The office continues to operate under the shared BEGA budget, but was allowed a separate allotment of $43,000 for the fiscal year to cover special projects, travel, office expenses, etc. The allotment is not intended to cover operating costs. At the start of the fiscal year, OOG first will turn over support of the BEGA website to the Ethics Office as of September 30th. This will require OGE to, one, turn over maintenance of the site to Okto, or two, work with a third-party vendor to maintain the site. This should not cause any disruption in operations of the site, as both BEGA.DC.gov and BEGA-DC.gov, both of those domains are registered to Okto and to BEGA, respectively. Mr. Khattab has arranged the training of ethics staff to make basic changes to the BEGA site in the interim. The FDS system, the financial disclosure system, OOG fulfilled its obligation over the summer to make the necessary changes for the most recent filing period. At the start of the fiscal year, OOG will discontinue long-term technical and troubleshooting support for the system. There were a few security patches for e-payment that either Okta or DataNet must handle. In addition, caching of the e-payment and the autofill for the system must be fixed. And we're continuing to work with Ms. Dillon in the ethics office to provide the documentation she needs regarding the changes that were made to the code and or site navigation during the summer so she can pass that information along to DataNet and Okta. I've made it clear to Director Sobin that OOG cannot continue to devote the amount of time and attention to the continued maintenance of a failing system that OGE anticipates needing to keep in place for the next 8 months to a year without fairly compensating Mr. Khattab for taking on responsibility that will only add to what he must do for OOG. I declined Director Sobin's offer to barter administrative support in exchange for Mr. Khattab continuing to work on the system. FOIA Express.
May I address that before we move on?
Yeah, I think, I mean, if I can just maybe short-circuit all this, it seems to me like what we need to do, based on what I know some of the ethics side issues are and what some of you I'm learning now more about what your issues are, is I think that we need to have sort of a sit-down and just go through kind of where we are money-wise, because I know that this is budget pressure on both sides. And rather than take up the meeting time now kind of hashing out this, because we're not going to resolve anything sitting here right now, I think what we need to do is come up more strategically with how to deal with it. And also, if we're going to make a pitch to the powers that be that actually control the purse strings, it needs to, because we as much as we all supported having separate budgets, we don't have it. And if we're going to do it, we're going to have to go to them unified. And so I know that you each have very strong feelings about kind of where the money needs to go and how it needs to be spent, and we have pressures everywhere. Just, I mean, it's just sort of the thing. So if I may propose that perhaps you, Ms. Hughes, you, Mr. Sobin, myself, and with the consent of the board, before we start delving into how we divide up the money, because look, we just started a brand new fiscal year, right? I mean, we're just like 5 days into this thing.
That's right.
Before we start trying to kind of do this out here in this environment, but we rather we sort of figure out what can be done with what we have, what else I might be able to do by talking to folks in the administration that might help resolve some of this stuff, or not, as the case may be, before we then start to have to, you know, cut and dice and paste all over the place. Because I know we have personnel issues, we have IT issues, we have infrastructure issues, and we have an imbalance of people in terms of where this goes, and also an imbalance of power, quite frankly, because that they control the budget largely. And so I, rather than delving into that right now, if I can ask, after my brief is due on Tuesday, if we can sit down, the three of us, kind of go through all this, maybe map out a plan. I don't know if we need A1 in the room to help out as well, from the CFO's office. But if I could do that with both of you, I think that maybe we can advance them all.
I agree. I do think, though, that it would be helpful for the full board to understand what the issues are.
Yeah.
Because to date, it's just been communications with you directly, Mr. Chairman.
That's fine, but it's in terms of, like, we could take another hour and a half going back and forth about we need money for this, we need money for this. And I'm not sure that's productive, as opposed to these are the pressures that we have. When he gets to his budget discussion, we're going to hear these are the budget pressures I have. Then we're aware of them. And then we can put them all on the table. And then we can come back to the full board and say, hey, look, this is kind of what we're going to do. Again, I mean, I'm just trying to advance the ball here. That's all.
All right, I agree. And that's precisely how I laid it out. I just wanted to put on the record what the pressures are for
the
Office of Open Government.
Okay, and I expect Mr. Sobin will do exactly the same.
Right, and it was not my intention for us to resolve everything today.
Right, no.
But this is the first time that I've had the opportunity to address the full body.
I understand.
So that we're all on the same page about what we need on this end.
I appreciate that. And then we'll just wait, Mr. Sobin, until you can just lay out all yours as well, and then we'll do this. Have a meeting with one of the three of us, come up with some plan, and then we can decide, you know, and share it with the full board, and then we'll go from there.
Okay.
All right.
FOIA Express. Upon my request, Octo has assigned an unused license to OGE at no cost for processing FOIA requests. To date, I have been the point of contact in the system for processing all FOIA requests for both OGE and OOG-related records. OGE will be responsible for processing all incoming requests for ethics records without needing to go through me to populate the records in the system, push records out through the system, and to issue all correspondence to the requester. 95% of the incoming requests are for ethics-related records. For annual reporting purposes, all requests processed with OGE and OOG will be reported under the one BIGA agency umbrella. So nothing will change there. As has always been the case, I will continue to assist OGE in processing FOIA requests. The P-Card. In anticipation of the $43,000 allocation within the BIGA budget for OOG, I have signed up for P-Card training. Mr. Katab has attended the training and has agreed to manage the OOG P-Card. I'm attending the training myself on October 18th. Equipment expenses and fixture costs. You all have in your folder the suggested charge that Mr. Sobin is recommending for operation costs. So this amount is being recommended as a charge, which the assumption is, as it stands now, would be taken from the $43,000 allotment.
Right.
So the proposed charge is $19,953 to be deducted from the $43,000 total for the entire fiscal year. That concludes my update. Thank you.
Any questions from the board members? No? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Mr. Sobin, Office of Government Ethics.
Oh, good morning, everybody.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think this brochure is really something. And when I see what you all do with your budgets and how I saw that film that was put together, I mean, I just think, having been connected with government, this government, for decades, I've just never seen such extraordinary staff work in both offices. And on the kinds of budgets they have, I've just never seen it. And then to see this kind of professionalism, it's just quite extraordinary, and I just wanted to point out how pleased I am with both offices.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention one thing, which is more pressing. We need to secure a process server to serve Mr. Yates, which is going to come at a cost. The Office of Government does not have a P-card. How would you like for us to handle that? Do you want me to do in-kind?
We could put it on our P-card.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
As an initial matter, I am very pleased to introduce to you BEGA's newest attorney, Ms. Janet Foster. Ms. Foster comes to us from the firm Schertler and Honorado and fills the vacancy left by Ms. Pat Selt. Ms. Foster is a graduate of Amherst College and the George Washington University Law School. She has experience in both criminal litigation and appellate practice through her clinic work. Ms. Foster is also a lifelong district resident, and we are very pleased to have her on board.
Good morning and welcome.
Okay, an update on our previous month's activities. We opened 3 investigations as opposed to last month's 4. We closed 3 investigations, so opened 3, closed 3, as opposed to 2 the previous month. That brings us to 19 investigations currently open. That's up a bit. It's a little above my comfort level of 14 to 15. But the investigations that have been stayed are constant at 20. Now, a large part of those 20 state cases, which is honestly a lot more than I want. I don't want more state cases than we have active cases. But a bunch of those are with respect to one entity, and the IG is investigating from a criminal perspective. I think it's about 7 or 8. Isn't that correct?
More than that.
It's more. It could be up to 12 or 13. And so once those come off, it's going to make that number look a lot
better. Absolutely.
All right, item B, publication and reporting obligations. We are in compliance with our publication and reporting obligations. We publish the quarterly complaint report on our website as required by Section 220 of the Ethics Act. A copy of that document was placed into the Dropbox for this meeting. This is the final report for fiscal year 2016 and reflects that during fiscal year 2016, we opened 79 cases and closed 54. The 79 opened cases include approximately 20, again, that have been stayed in deference to other law enforcement entities or others that may be investigating the same matters. Item C, trainings and outreach. This is a crazy month for training. Let me just mention the symposium that's coming up and all the hard work that the staff has been doing to put that together. It's going to be, the best practice symposium is being combined with Ethics Day at the David A. Clark School of Law. The theme this year is Ethics, Victim of an Outsourced Government. The Ethics Day program will allow folks to fulfill both their CLE and mandatory ethics training obligations. Mr. Grimaldi is in the process of scheduling a conference call with the panelists of the symposium in preparation for the event. Those panelists include the Attorney General, Carl Racine, the Chairman of the Council, Phil Mendelson, General Counsel to the Mayor, Betsy Cavendish, on the executive side, Mr. Grimaldi, what's the name of the law?
Terrence O'Connell.
Terrence O'Connell, who's an expert in government procurement and has written several pieces on that. So, and again, Dean Broderick will be the moderator.
Can you remind us of the date, please?
October 20th.
Okay. And from what time to what time?
Well, the program's going to start, they're going to be back-to-back, the training classes, starting at 9:30 in the morning. And continuing on right up until evening with a break for lunch. And the symposium itself is going to start at 6 and run till about 8 o'clock. Traditionally, the law school puts on a small reception for us afterwards. We'll see if they're going to do that this year. We have the event posted on a vendor called Eventbrite so that people are able to register for each separate class so we know how many we're going to have for each one. We have a record. So far it's working well. All right, let's see. Attended by staff. There were three. Attorneys Cooks and Foster attended a 4-day intense trial skills program, including a mock trial facilitated by the National Institute of Trial Advocacy, or NITA. Senior Attorney Grimaldi attended an ADA training course. He is our ADA coordinator for the office. And I'd really like to thank the Attorney General, Carl Racine, for allowing our attorneys to attend the NITA event. It's, you know, a first-rate and very expensive program, and we were able to go for free, which, again, takes some of the pressure off of our budget. Conducted by staff. This is actually a remarkable number when I saw it this morning. 17. Which is almost a training per day over a 20-day workday month. It's three times the five that we conducted last month during August, and this includes one regular two-hour monthly ethics training, three new employee orientations and three MSS trainings, two board and commission trainings, including one at the Board of Chiropractic, two Office of Administrative Hearing trainings for the ALJs, and for the non-legal staff, two retirement board trainings, three DC One Fund trainings. We are in One Fund season now, and one training session at the Alcohol Beverage Control Board Administration that included a longer Hatch Act session. In addition, I served as a guest lecturer last night at the George Washington University Law School in Councilmember Mary Shea's ethics class. So we've all been going in different directions all month, and I really appreciate the staff covering these trainings, even during busy work days. Advisory opinions, advice. We did 68. We answered 68 informal inquiries since the last meeting. That was up from 62 the previous month. Since the date of the last meeting, we have issued two formal advisory opinions, both of which dealt primarily with post-employment issues and will be published in the D.C. Register this Friday. Both opinions are on the Vega website. The first opinion dealt with a former chief engineer for DDOT who asked whether he could represent his new employer in responding to an RFP for a $600 million project. We found that because he had participated personally and substantially on the contract while he was employed for DDOT, that he could not represent the company on that contract, but could permissibly work behind the scenes. Again, always with the caveat that no confidential information is shared. The second opinion was prepared by, or was prepared for, former council member Vincent Orange on the permissible parameters of his new job as head of the D.C. Chamber of Commerce. At least two press reports have summarized the opinion, reflecting that the council code of conduct imposed few restrictions on the former council member's appearances before his former colleagues. Both stories mentioned the pending comprehensive code of conduct as Vega's response to what we perceive as that problem.
Right, I saw both of those.
And I've been plugging it right along with everybody that I speak to at the council, including last night with Council Member Shea. Item E, Ethics Legislation, Comprehensive Code of Conduct. The projected dates for the Comprehensive Code of Conduct are under consideration. The council is back from recess, and the Judiciary Committee clearly appears to be moving the Comprehensive Code along. In fact, Senior Attorney Grimaldi spoke with committee staff about 2 weeks ago and was told that the plan was to mark up the bill later this month. We're keeping a close eye on the committee schedule because I plan to attend that markup along with Mr. Grimaldi and perhaps Mr. Flowers. Hopefully we'll have a more definite update for you next month.
Okay.
Rulemaking. The long-promised rulemaking is here. Changes to the rules that I've been mentioning to you at the last several meetings. In your meeting folders, you will find proposed changes to 16 sections of our rules. This is the result of 7 weekly working sessions during which we reviewed each chapter of our rules section by section. There are approximately 12 additional sections that we hope to have before the board shortly. Those sections deal with financial disclosures and honoraria, registration of lobbyists, non-public admonitions, and negotiated dispositions and definitions. During the course of the review, we determined that a number of rules may be affected by the adoption of the Comprehensive Code of Conduct legislation that is pending before the council. You just mentioned it. Nonetheless, we thought it important to inform the board of the proposed changes that do not appear in the affected or to be affected by that legislation.
And I will confess I have not had a chance to go through them all yet, but I'm glad that you guys spent a lot of time on this, and it looks like there are a number of things.
I think you've seen them all before.
Changes?
Yeah. I mean, at least most of them. We were discussing them early on, and then we had to sort of take a hiatus.
Got it.
Before we finalized it, so a lot of this stuff isn't new. Plus, for the new board members, of course it is.
It's all new, yeah. Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay. Item G on the budget. We're only several days into the new fiscal year, but we're already anticipating budget pressure.
Surprise.
This is because of the expected outlay of funds for IT support, temporary assistance while two of our employees are on FMLA starting in December, and the overhaul of our FDS lobbyist e-filing system. I have reached out to the mayor's budget office to request additional funds during this fiscal year, but the response I received was that there are no surplus funds currently available. Just FYI, we absolutely need another administrative staff person to help with FDS and lobbyist duties, and I will be relentless in making that pitch to the mayor's budget folks as we start preparation of the fiscal year 18 budget.
Yeah, no, and we've had discussions about how much time, overtime, the staff has put in to manage those systems, and it's just, I mean, you clearly have plenty of work for at least one more, if not two more, administrative folks to help out with that. It's just overwhelming.
And the FMLA is really going to throw a wrench into that. So we're continuing that effort.
Although we're happy that our family's expanding, but...
item H, staffing. With the addition of Ms. Foster, we are once again fully staffed. Item I, lobbyist financial disclosure matters. For the past few months, Vega has enlisted the assistance of the Office of the Chief Technology Officer to work with Vega staff to assess our current FDS and lobbyist e-filing systems. This effort focused on the review, analysis, and documentation of both systems to include documenting any required enhancements to the applications. These applications support a core function of Vega's mission, critical operations, FDS, and lobbyist. The assessment was completed last week, And the next step, we believed, was to use it as part of a request for proposals to outside vendors. However, Okto has graciously offered to continue to work with Bega in a series of whiteboarding sessions in an effort to find a global IT solution for the agency that would not only cover FDS and lobbyist matters, but all of Bega's processes and functions, such as intake, case tracking, collection, etc. It would pull them all together. This is a costly review and process, and we really do appreciate that Okto is willing to do this for us gratis.
Yes, and I will spare you my editorial comments about Okto doing things for free. It rarely happens.
That's correct. But I will say, the review that we paid for that was done and submitted last week, we had negotiated a fixed price of no more than, I think it was $15,000, based on a certain number of hours that their folks would have to devote. And they far exceeded the number of hours and didn't charge us anything over the agreed-upon price.
Right.
Because they wanted to do the job right. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, Okto, they do terrific work, because they exist on a fee-for-service basis almost exclusively, you're paying for it, that's for sure.
In addition, Okto will take control of the Bega website, providing hosting, maintenance, and enhancements 24/7, and this should occur in the next couple of weeks. One of these enhancements will be a searchable engine that would enable a user to search specific keywords, and the search engine generate results based upon the keyword. This is a feature we've been hoping to include in our website for quite a while. Lobbyists, let's see. In the Dropbox, you will see a summary of the July 2016 Lobbyist Activity Reports, or LAR, desk review conducted by our auditor, Ms. Alawamne. These were filed on or before August 4th, 2016. The review focused on disclosures made on LAR Schedule A2, which includes political contributions and gifts made from lobbyists to benefit an official in the executive or legislative branch. These lobbyist disclosures are significant because they are then used to analyze each financial disclosure statement filed by a public official or a designated public filer. The information is also compared with donations that have been disclosed by council members who may have accepted donations from lobbyists on the council's website. A total of 35 lobbyists disclosed political contributions. No gifts and donations were disclosed. The memo also summarizes the significant subject areas lobbyists focused on during the reporting period, January 1, 2016 through June 30, 2016. Ms. Alawamne makes one recommendation. Inquiry letters should be sent to several of the entities who were mentioned in the LAR to ascertain their business relationships with the lobbyists that disclose them as their clients, including how long the affected lobbyists have been working for each of them, and if any, what activities these entities had authorized the lobbyists to undertake on their behalf. Essentially, you want to find out if you're lobbying and you're not registered, you need to be registered.
Right.
And that's what this will determine. Okay. Item 2, financial disclosure. Despite our best efforts, there are 3 current district employees who we have had to fine for failure to file their FDS.
Okay, the mere fact that it's only 3 is nothing short of incredible.
Right.
I mean, it really is. This is just, I know that we're not happy with these 3 people, but it does show that the mountain of effort that you and your staff are putting into this is paying off, because as we've said a million times, we don't want to have to enforce against anybody. We will if we have to, but
yep.
The goal is just to get them to disclose,
that's
and
right.
Your efforts have really proved successful.
Okay, well, for these 3 folks, Clarence Hume, Sunday Riggins, and Cynthia Davis.
Not so much.
Each of these employees was designated as a public filer by their agencies early in the year and notified of their requirement to file. However, they all failed to file. By the deadline, the employees were fined $300 in early September for not filing and given until September 21st to pay the fine and file. None of the employees paid the late filing fine, and none of these employees have still filed their financial disclosure statement. As a result, the Office of Government Ethics initiated a collection action against them for the $300 for late filing by asking the Office of Pay and Retirement Services to deduct the $300 from their next paychecks. Our office notified each of these employees in writing that it had initiated this collection action. Mr. Humes and Ms. Riggins respectively replied that if they will be fined, then, quote, so be it, and that the deduction is, quote, fine. Both employees also asked for an explanation for why they were required to file, and one was again provided. To date, Ms. Davis has not replied to any communication from the OGE. None of these individuals, again, have yet filed. We would expect to have a notice of violation prepared for each one of them for board consideration at the November board meeting.
Just so
now it's an intentional refusal to comply with it.
So just so the public becomes aware of this, what is the potential sanction for someone who knowingly and willingly fails to file an FDS?
$5,000.
All right. So it may be true that for some folks, and we had this discussion about lobbyists as well, the cost of doing business when the fine is statutorily capped at $300, they can decide whether or not that makes sense. But there are collateral consequences. For lobbyists, your inability to continue to register exists on the unclean hands version of things. And for government employees, you weren't going to have to pay anything, but I was willing to pay $300 turns into I may have to pay $5,000. That may get their attention.
Yep, and we would hope that at some point their agency may get involved on the personnel side.
On the personnel side, exactly. Well, that's – have they been – are they – I know this is all public. Obviously, we're discussing and they have to be published in the DC Register. But has there been any direct communications with the with their respective agencies about this?
Not yet.
Okay.
Again, we're very sensitive to
urging
personnel matters in what we do.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but it's coming.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Item two, our II confidential filers. We don't have any updates for you. There's a lot of work to do there, though, I will admit. Again, it's just a resource and staffing issue. So we have two waiver requests under II underneath, and I think I'm going to let each of the two attorneys who worked on these address them.
Sure.
Ms. Foster and Mr. Chanoon, want to come up and bring a seat up?
Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board.
Right into the fire, eh, Ms. Foster?
Thank you all. The first waiver request is in the matter of Edwin Adokwe. Mr. Adokwe is a civil engineer. He's with the Department of Transportation. He concedes that he makes the statutory minimum to be considered a public filer. His duties include advising in the decision-making process, participating in the oversight and inspection of construction contractors, and the review of design, development, and construction drawings that are submitted with those permit applications. All of those duties impact the financial decisions that developers and contractors make, and it can thus create a conflict of interest insofar as they affect the finances of those developers and contractors that come before Mr. Adokwe. So as a result of this potential for conflict, requiring Mr. Adokwe to file one of those public financial disclosure statements is one of the few mechanisms available to ensure that he does not develop an improper relationship with the persons and or entities that come before him. Accordingly, we request that you deny Mr. Adokwe's waiver request.
Okay, so now, just so that we're all clear, he was designated by the head of DDOT, is that right, as a public filer?
By the ethics officer within DDOT, that's
right.
Correct.
So, and he, do you know whether or not he challenged his designation within the agency or just with us?
We do have an email that he sent to Mr. Dubin, who
right,
is that ethics officer,
right.
Saying I should not have
been. And the general counsel, is that right?
Yes, I think both, saying that he disagreed with the designation. And then we have a response from that, from Mr. Dubin saying, no, you should file for all of these reasons. And, including the fact that he participates in permitting, overseeing contractors.
Right. And I take it he's not the only civil engineer with DDOT.
That's correct.
That, and the others who make that same amount of money or more, the requirement, they, they were all designated in their file, so he wasn't singled out in any way?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, I've read what he submitted, and I've read OGE's response, and I, for all of the reasons in that response, essentially, is he meets the qualifications, I think, fairly easily, and is not set forth any reason to believe he should not be designated as a public filer. I would vote to deny the waiver request.
I vote to deny the waiver request.
I also vote to deny.
Okay, so it's unanimous. If you'll present an order, I'll be happy to sign it.
I have the order right now, if I can first.
Court might want to notice that the order provides a direction to Mr. Odokwe to file.
Yes, that would be helpful as well. Let's see if we can get past that hurdle before we wind up adding him to the NOV category. Great. Thank you very much. And welcome to the fray. Mr. Shanoon, you're old hand now, right?
Without a doubt.
You used to be the new kid on the block. That didn't last very long, did it?
My times have changed.
Yes.
Good morning. The next waiver request is it concerns Ms. Charlene Dickens. Ms. Dickens is a transportation engineer with the Department of Transportation. She concedes that she makes...
It's a revolution going on over DDOT, isn't it?
It really is. She concedes that she makes the statutory minimum to be considered a public filer. Her duties include reviewing and assessing transportation plans, which can create a conflict of interest insofar as her duties affect the finances of developers and contractors that come before her. As a result of this potential for conflict, requiring Ms. Dickens to file a public financial disclosure statement is one of the few mechanisms to ensure a proper relationship between her and the persons and or entities coming before her. Accordingly, we request that you deny Ms. Dickens' waiver request.
Okay, and so similarly, remarkably similarly, actually, I read her materials that reflect her arguments that essentially she reviews these, but she's not necessarily deciding anything
major,
and she's provided a definition of assessment that apparently deals mostly with tax assessment rather than evaluation of the stuff that she actually does. I take it she's not the only transportation engineer making the requisite amount of money who's been designated a public filer by DDOT?
Correct.
Right. So I wonder how close their desks are to each other. In any event, I would, for all the reasons we've discussed, I would go ahead and vote to deny the waiver request. Ms. Schwartz?
I vote to deny as well.
Ms. Hutchison?
I also vote to deny.
And Mr. Wade?
Vote to deny.
Unanimous, and I will again sign the order. Does this one also instruct Ms. Dickens to file?
Oh, yes, it does.
Okay. And I take it if she doesn't, we'll hear about it. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Okay.
All right. On to item J, our non-confidential investigations. First up is 1426-001 In Re Jaron Price.
Right.
The parties recently submitted a proposed scheduling order to the board for approval. And there are some other things I think that...
Yeah, there's a motion. There's a motion pending by Mr. Price's attorney to late file a motion in limine for the hearing that's set for next week. And so we are for the record, we are scheduled to have Mr. Price's hearing on the 13th, potentially going to the 14th. So do you want to join us up here for the discussion? Sure. And you just identify yourself for the record when you get closer to the mic.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Eric Williams, and I'm the attorney for Jaron Price, who is the respondent in this matter.
And so just so that we're all clear, we're scheduled next week for a hearing. There was a notice of violation that was issued by the board. We've been through some preliminary matters. You all have submitted a joint pre-hearing statement after we revised the date. And there is now pending at the moment a motion to late file a motion in limine to the motion essentially relates to recordings of Mr. Price, and you're seeking to exclude them from the hearing that's coming up next week. OG has filed a response objecting that the late filing should not be permitted because of the essentially passed by the date. No one ever addressed the date that by which motions eliminate should be filed, and that you've not offered a compelling reason to do so. I've read all the papers, and just so that we're all kind of clear about what the rules provide, and just so that we have a couple new board members, and this is actually Ms. Schwartz's first adversarial contested hearing since she joined the board, our rules provide that the chair presides over these contested hearings. As a practical matter, in sort of the give and take of an ongoing hearing, what's going to happen next week, if there are motions, there are objections, you know, admissions, that kind of stuff, I'll just go ahead and rule on them as the presiding official. However, if there is an issue that comes up that's one that the other board members feel like they want to weigh in on before a decision is made, they are certainly encouraged to and ought to voice their opinion. But what we don't do, the rules don't provide for it, and we just because it would slow things down interminably, we don't pause every time that there is a motion or an issue of admissibility really kind of any procedural thing that's going on or even evidentiary thing to take a vote of the entire board before we move forward. That would be cumbersome. Again, the rules don't provide it. But in the interest of including voices, if there is an issue that sort of jumps out at these very experienced folks, then I encourage them all publicly to go ahead and say it. But otherwise, I'm just going to rule and we're going to go ahead just so we can move on to the next thing. So again, if there's something else that you want to add to your motion, I'm happy to hear it. Otherwise, we can go ahead and I can get to the ruling part of this. Mr. Williams, anything else you want to say about your motion?
Well, thank you.
Mr. Chair is fine.
Mr. Chair.
Or Mr. Spagnoletti, although Mr. Chair is a whole lot easier to say.
I have a wonderful client, and every time she calls me, she says, "Good morning, Your Honor."
Yeah.
So she's from the wonderful part of West Africa, the Gold Coast. And so I always feel privileged when she says, "Good morning, Your Honor." So I just wanted you to feel I feel when she says, "Good morning, Your Honor." Well, what I like to say is this is my first time appearing before Bega, and I took on this case, Mr. Price. My primary specialty is employment law, EEOC, D.C. Office of Human Rights. And I took on this case because I believe in his innocence, 100%. And I took on this case late in the game. Mm-hmm. And the board has been so kind to grant various motions to continue and other motions to allow us to move forward so that Mr. Price could have a fair day in court. There was confusion on my part in terms of the due date for the motion in limine. I take full responsibility for my misunderstanding of not recognizing that when we extended the time to file the joint pre-hearing statement, that the motion in limine was not also included in that extension. And that is my responsibility. As I said, this is my first time appearing. And Mr. Grimaldi, he has been very helpful and very kind. But simply, I feel that this motion is very important, and that I would ask that the board at least give us the opportunity to file the motion. If you deny the motion, then obviously that's your choice. But we would at least like the opportunity to file this motion.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Williams.
Thank you.
Ms. Cooks.
Good morning, board members. Ashley Cooks on behalf of OGE. We stick to our arguments in the motion that respondent has not provided any compelling explanation for why the board should allow him to file his motion in limine out of time. Again, respondent had notice and opportunity. He had noticed that OGE planned to include his recordings, and he had three opportunities to file his motion in limine timely. Pursuant to the first scheduling order that was issued in July, OGE issued respondent a list of exhibits on August 26th. That list included his two recorded statements. Secondly, when we met for the pre-hearing conference On September 19th, OGE also informed Respondent then that they intended to include his two recorded interviews. Respondent then objected, but still failed to file the motion. And OGE submitted their draft of the joint pre-hearing statement on September 20th. Again, Respondent had an opportunity to file his motion in limine, and it would have been timely. With all due respect, confusion, assumption that the filing deadline for motions should have been extended with the joint hearing motions, with the joint hearing statement, is not a compelling explanation. We just submit on our arguments in the motion that Respondent had ample opportunity and notice to file his motion in limine.
Thank you.
If I may, just one point.
For sure.
It is true that in the August 26th filing that they did list those recordings in their list of exhibits. At that time, they listed 24 exhibits. And then in the final joint pre-hearing statement, that exhibit list grew to 35. And as I stated in my motion, it was my understanding that the two went hand in hand, because until those lists are actually finalized, at least this is my understanding, that documents could be added, documents could be taken off of list. And so if they want to say that the August 26th list holds, then that only listed 24 exhibits.
Although it did include the recorded statements.
Yes, but my understanding was that at any time they could have made changes to their list. That's one point. The other point is, I based it on past pattern and practice of the other orders that the board had made, where the joint pre-hearing statement and the motions in limine were linked together in terms of when they were due.
Right. So I certainly feel your pain, Mr. Williams, when you come into the game sort of late and your clients already had opportunities to do things and miss deadlines, trying to dig yourself out of a hole. I found myself in that position at the moment in my private practice. However, that being said, is that the standard that we apply, the rules require, is a compelling reason. And here's why I don't find it compelling. One is that, I mean, you did have multiple opportunities, and this, it's hard to say that this was not, if not at the top of the list of potential evidence that OG is going to use. It's like second or third on the list. Because this is a nepotism case. He came in, gave two record interviews, and I read the substantive motion as well, and raising the due process issues, and to the extent that they still exist, to the extent that he hasn't waived any of that stuff, and I think there may be arguments about waiver along the way, certainly in the hearing itself, if OGE ceased to compel him to testify, which they could try to do, it's a civil proceeding, he certainly couldn't assert anything then. The other reason why I don't find it compelling is that it's not dispositive of the underlying issue. Let's say hypothetically, even if we were to consider the underlying motion, you've only sought to suppress the recorded statements, but you've not asked to suppress the content of what he said, which means that they could put a witness who was present during the interview and still say, we may not have the benefit of the tape itself, but the content still would come in. So it doesn't change the dynamics necessarily of what's gone on, given the way you filed your motion. So for the more procedural side, as well as what might be the substantive side of things, I don't find it compelling. Again, if either one of those things broke differently, I might feel differently about it. But in light of everything that's laid out here, and given the fact that the hearing is next Thursday, and the weight of how this played out in terms of how it was disclosed, when it was disclosed, before you were even entering into the case, I'm going to go ahead to deny the motion to late file the substantive motion without getting to the substance. He retains his due process rights, his Fifth Amendment rights, and everything else that may play out during the course of the hearing itself. Is there anything else that we need to resolve before? I do want to say a few things about Thursday before we all leave the subject. No? Okay. So,
thank you, Your Honor.
Oh, no problem. We'll break you of that habit. You can stay, Mr. Williams, for just another minute. So next week, we have a bunch of days between now and next week, and I would always urge the parties every opportunity I get to still talk, consult. Whether or not there's a potential resolution of this, I don't know. I'm out of the game, the resolution game. If Mr. Grimaldi in his semi-mediator role can play any role of assistance, please feel free to call on him. His wife is going to be out of town, so he's got plenty of time. Again, because it's time well spent if you think that it can be done. Also, when we get to the hearing itself, I will remind you all now, because I know how things get when you actually start the hearing itself, we are not the Superior Court. We are not the Supreme Court of the United States. We're not the Court of Appeals. We are an administrative body. We are a branch of the executive arm of the government, okay? The federal rules of evidence do not control this, not specifically. Hearsay is permitted as long as it's generally reliable, not, you know, crazy stuff. But so in terms of both what you will – and it sounds like you are working collaboratively on exhibits and not challenging the authenticity of things that there's no real question about. You always challenge the admissibility based on relevance or, you know, whether you laid a proper foundation, that kind of stuff. But when we get to the hearing itself, please just try to keep in mind as we go through this that we do have a relaxed view of the rules of evidence. Also, we're smart people, and we will read if you ask us to read something, so don't feel like you need to go out of your way to present things in a fashion that will cost a lot of money or a lot of time if there are particular things you want. I say, for example, like if there's a piece of the recorded testimony that you'd like to use and there's a piece that they'd like to use, we could focus on the piece that's recorded as opposed to listening to, you know, I don't know how long these things are, the entire thing to stop and start and stop and start and just to those relevant parts. So please feel free to focus in on what you think the most important evidence is that we need to hear. You know what the charges are. You know what they relate to. And again, I say that we are an administrative body. Have you all spoken about the, comfortability? We are recorded on video and audio. And we will be for the course of the hearing. You have the opportunity, of course, to have a court reporter actually take reported testimony. You guys have to figure out the expense of this. I know that's pressure on their budget, and you know, this is the consequences for Mr. Price if he were to be found guilty of nepotism are significant. So I understand money's an issue. I am personally, as chair of the board, thanks, Ms. Hughes, confident this system will capture what we need, and we will, I'm assuming, have a backup handheld.
Yeah, I think the plan right now is to just do the audio, because the audio and the visual would be too much for the system and might create problems. Is that correct?
When the recording is done, it's a video recording. We extract the audio
and
pull it off the server.
It's just a matter of what you do with it afterwards.
Yeah. Okay. So in process, you cannot extract the two.
I see. Okay, I misunderstood then. So right now we're being visually recorded as well? Okay. All right, well, listen, if they can give us some reasonable assurance that we'll be able to record the entire proceeding and have...
Yeah,
it's what OAH does.
Sure, you know, I'm totally... And even in Superior Court, but for, you know, contested hearings where they're going to put on witnesses, they have a, you know, an online recording system that does a large part of what they do. So I'm comfortable doing that. But I put that out there because, this is Mr. Williams' first time and I want to make sure he knows he has that opportunity to do so. What was the starting time again?
10 a.m.
10 a.m., right. So, if you all could just be ready to start at 10 and move along and, to the extent that we can, I know that if you add up all the time that both sides project, it becomes a very long hearing. I would urge you all to think about whether all that's done. Anyway, we're just projecting and stuff changes. And we did keep Friday available for this purpose. But, these are not the Nuremberg trials. And if we can, go ahead and find out ways to put on what needs to be put on in this administrative hearing, it would move everything along. Okay? Great.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we'll see you all next Thursday.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Mr. Sobin?
Give me one second, please.
Yeah.
Okay. Next item is going to be the Adrian Williams matter.
10-19-011 Adrian Williams. This was the case that involved a DOS employee
offering sexual propositions to a DOES client. Mr. Williams was actually arrested and charged for sexual solicitation. He entered into a deferred sentencing agreement with the U.S. Attorney's Office, which requires him to complete 48 hours of community service. We recently spoke with Mr. Williams' attorney, and she stated that Mr. Williams has refused to come into OGE for an interview. He would prefer that OGE notify him of our investigative findings after we've completed our investigation. According to his attorney, he has a scheduling hearing scheduled for it sometime in December to show the court that he has completed his 48 hours of community service. Based on the evidence that we've collected that a code of conduct violation has occurred, and Mr. Williams' refusal to cooperate with our investigation, we ask that the board issue subpoena authority in this case.
Yes, at least I will vote for yes. But here's the other thing. So for the other board members who may not deal in this world, the deferred sentencing agreement is a way by which someone in Superior Court who's been charged with a crime can avoid at the end of the day a conviction. However, it requires you to go into the courtroom, plead guilty, under oath, admit a set of facts that make out the crime, and then go ahead and do your conditions. And then that's why they call it deferred sentencing. They defer your sentencing. And in the District of Columbia, unless you are sentenced, you're not convicted. And assuming he goes and does all the things he's required to do, the community service and whatever else that's part of the agreement, he can come back in, and then the government just dismisses the case so that it is gone at the end of the day. And because he was never sentenced, he's not technically convicted. However, he is admitted under oath already, apparently. And again, I don't know what he admitted to. So I would, if you haven't already done so, you, in addition to going ahead and issuing the subpoena, you might want to pull that transcript where he admits whatever it is that he admitted doing. Or the tape. They're not automatically transcribed for deferred sentencing agreements. So you may need to go to the court and ask for permission to get that excerpt from the tape. So there you have it.
Okay, thank you.
So we have authorization to issue
subpoena. I vote to issue the subpoena.
I vote to issue the subpoena.
I vote to issue the subpoena.
I vote as well, yes.
Thank you.
You have it.
Okay, that concludes our item J, non-confidential investigations.
All right, so now we move to the opportunity for public comment. I saw Mr. Syndrome here a minute ago, so we might want to, Mr. Cook, if I could impose upon you, I know, but if I could impose upon you just because otherwise we're going to go to a closed session and then he may feel frustrated that he didn't get a chance to speak to us. So, yes, I know. All right, so this is, the time is now 12:02. We've finished the public portion of the meeting. At this time, we will, as we always do in our meetings, open up an opportunity for public comment for any members of the public who wish to address the board on things that are properly before the board. We afford private citizens 3 minutes each and organizations 5 minutes. Similar to the council. And so at this time, I see Mr. Syndrome here. Would you like to address us? Please come join the table. You've got 3 minutes. And please identify yourself, although I think I just did. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge, along with your associate judges or justices.
I am moving right up the scale here.
Indeed you are. Very enlightening. I would say Professor Instructor Spagnoletti as well.
That would be me.
And then you have the voice of experience seated right near you, the Councilwoman Extraordinaire. Yes, looking well. Every time I see you, look younger and younger.
I love it.
Yes. I had occasion yesterday to have a chat, shall we say, tender moments of bonding with ACE Investigator Ron Cook. I'm a little more discombobulated following our meeting. So hopefully we can become on one accord. Issues involve Philip Heath Mendelson. And to Mr. Cook's credit, he did come by my humble abode. copy of the BIGA rules and regs were delivered, the governing law. That's helpful. So I believe it's squarely, within your bailiwick to grapple with. I understand the status of the good chair, may alter that shouldn't, but the status is what I'm getting to. In any event, like some headway on that, there's also issues involving LaRue May. And again, it gave rise for Mr. Cook to make a home visit, took some pictures. It's confirmed the issues at hand. I'm not just making stuff up. So
it sounds like you've raised some issues of concern with Mr. Cook, one of our investigators.
Yes.
Who's here at the moment. And he came to you and you provided him with some information about something you believe might constitute a code of conduct violation.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
By Chairman Mendelson and Council Member,
Lou Ruby May.
Okay.
Who's soon to depart. So it's a time sensitive matter, at least with regard to her.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, the one thing I know about Mr. Cook is he doesn't let balls drop. And so I'm sure that he'll be following up on what it is that you, and again, we're not privy and we don't get privy until they do some more investigation to what it is that you complained about or made a complaint about. The one thing I do want to say is that based on what you started your comment about that Chairman Mendelson's status, we are an independent body and we take our independence very seriously. And as I think our history has shown right out of the gate, we had to demonstrate this, that we are not uncomfortable or unwilling to address, potential ethics violations, no matter where in the government food chain they might be, from the mayor all the way on down to the lowest and paid employee. So regardless, everyone still has the same obligations. Some have different ones based on their position, what the statute's written, but by and large, we hold everyone equally accountable. We have sanctioned council members and as well as secretaries. So, but I appreciate your raising that.
And if I may follow up, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I believe this is an impartial, objective tribunal, which is a breath of fresh air, because the culture of corruption, the cesspool of corruption at the Granite Palace, the Wilson Building, is just daunting. I need not say more. In any event, last session that I spoke, I was somewhat blindsided by Executive Director Subin. He had made mention of what I characterize as a pre-filing injunction. And I wanted to bring to your attention, and I failed to bring hard copy, but it's on LexisNexis, you can pull it up. It's a case captioned Michael Syndrome versus Gerald Bruce Lee. He's a federal judge.
I know Judge Lee.
Okay. Yes. And what had happened was, essentially, my reputation precedes me, so there's no way to get around that. In any event, the good judge shut me down. And the Fourth Circuit came down on him and says, time out. You minimally are to give Mr. Syndrome notice and an opportunity to be heard, to which the good judge and other parties named did not do that. So he got a spanking. It was overturned. So my point is, in what was made mention, again, being blindsided, this pre-filing injunction, I was not, nor have ever been given a notice nor an opportunity to be heard. So you wanted to say something?
No. I mean, my recollection of what occurred before, and obviously you're speaking to Mr. Cook, the mere fact that you're going by the procedures in terms of the way we take in our complaints right now, right, suggests to me that is, and again, I don't know where that lands and how it comes, but that part seems, that is working the way it was intended to be, that you have an issue, you're giving it to the investigator, he's going to follow up, and then we'll go from there. I think that, as I recall before, it was the filing of what amounts to a sworn complaint, and which triggers a whole host of things that we are then required to do in timelines and the rest, and also public information and the rest. When a lot of what we do is meant to ensure not just that violations are investigated, but the integrity of the people who are accused until we have reason to believe that there's a code of conduct, reasonable belief that there's a code of conduct violation. So I don't, if what you're saying is that you were unaware of the previous letter, it was a letter, is that right, Mr. Sobin, that was sent to Mr. Syndrome? Is that the way it came?
Yes.
It was a letter, as
yes.
I recall, that basically said, look, you'd filed a number of sworn complaints that triggered a concern on our part that essentially was, look, each time you do one of these, a whole series of things that you may or may not be aware of has to take place. and that we essentially were asking you to, before you start before you file formal sworn complaints that create this, that start this public mechanism, that you basically have a consultation, right? Isn't that where this all came down? A consultation?
It's been a while now.
but, I mean, Mr. Cook, is that my recollection is that it was to encourage a discussion about what the evidence looked like before these things got filed. I mean, we don't have the power to enjoin you from filing a sworn complaint, right? Well, I mean, I'm not a federal district court. I don't have that power to do it. We do have the power as a board to sanction folks who file meritless complaints. We do have that power, which we've never used and hopefully we'll never have to use. I think that we did not issue by any way, shape, or form the pre-filing injunction that Judge Lee issued in your case. Yeah, I haven't read it, but I'm assuming if it got overturned by the Court of Appeals, it was pretty severe.
Or circuit, most conservative, one of the most conservative.
So my, I guess what I'm saying is, we can all take a look at the letter, going forward. But in terms of future, I think the whole purpose of that exchange, as I recall it, was to encourage you, if you had a complaint that you thought was that implicated a code of conduct violation, is to do what you're doing now, which essentially is to have a conversation with somebody before you trigger an entire mechanism. And that's no different. That conversation is no different than we would have with anybody else. The only thing that's different is we put it in writing for you. I think we're having trouble getting a hold of you for some reason. And we're trying.
Not a hard guy to find.
Well, at any given moment, I mean, not on hearing days, you're not a hard guy to find. But at any given moment, you may have been at the time. And because we got in a flurry of these all at once, again, this is my recollection sitting here now in 2016. My recollection is what we were encouraging you to do. We didn't say don't file. We can't prohibit you from it. We don't have the power to do that. Prohibit you from filing it. What we do have the power to do is only sanction misbehavior. What we were trying to do is avoid all of that by saying, just take a step back, breathe, talk to somebody. It sounds like you're doing that for these particular matters. And I don't know what they are. I'm not weighing in them. It would be improper for me to do so.
I appreciate your enlightenment. Just briefly, if I may, Mr. Chair, what precipitated this was the Office of Human Rights. And it was a settlement agreement of which there was some pay-to-play hanky-panky going on, okay? And the investigator at the time in Biga had connection. And that's what unraveled and made me out to be the bad guy, you know? And I was further victimized, so.
Okay. So we've had time that's passed. You're talking to, as you pointed out, one of our ACE investigators. He will undoubtedly make sure the information gets followed up on. But let's see where we go from here.
Okay.
We're now 15 minutes into your three.
Well,
part of it was mine, but I agree.
Yeah. Two things just to wrap up very, very briefly. And I'd like to further dialogue with Mr. Cook. He's a fine investigator. Two things. I made mention, and I don't give compliments lightly to you.
And a great barbecue chef as well, by the way.
Is that right? Okay. Weight a man's heart is to his stomach, not the only way, but a main way. Two whistleblowers I want to bring to your attention, and I'll share the particulars with Mr. Cook. One is the Office of Human Rights. The mediation manager was recently terminated. Not good. And I'll give the particulars. I can give her name now if you'd like.
No.
Okay.
I'd rather you not.
I'll withhold that. There's another issue. With a well-known community activist who has uncovered ethical violations, to put it mildly, with the Board of Elections and Board of Elections. So I will share the contact information and give, you know, follow-up, and then Mr. Cook, you know, can take it from there.
Right. Okay? Thank you very much,
yes,
Mr.
Sir.
Senator.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Yes, sir.
All right. Any other members of the public wish to come forward? All right. So the time is 12:13. We are going to go ahead and adjourn the public portion of the meeting, and if I can get an appropriate motion to move to a closed executive session. Let me just put on the hang on one second. Because I have to, statutorily, I want to make sure that we're clear about why we're going to a closed session. We're moving to a closed session pursuant to discuss ongoing confidential investigations under DC Code 2-575B. To deliberate on a decision where the Ethics Board will exercise quasi-judicial functions pursuant to 2-575B13 and personnel matters pursuant to 2-575B10. All right, the time is 12:52, and we're back on the public record. There are two matters to report out from the closed session. One is that during the closed session, the board voted to issue a subpoena in the matter of Adrian Williams. Mr. Williams pled guilty in Superior Court to one count of sexual solicitation, and we are subpoenaing his cooperation for an interview in our investigation. The second matter is case number 1552-001, In Re Halle Clem. The board was presented with and has approved a notice of violation charging Ms. Clem with six counts, seeking or negotiating for employment in a manner conflicting with official government duties and responsibilities, appearance of using public office for private gain, conduct not compatible with the full and proper discharge of government duties, and conduct interfering with her ability to perform a district job in a completely independent and impartial manner, participating personally substantially in a particular matter involving an affiliated organization, and communicating with a former agency with the intent to influence the agency. This will be published publicly, and we will be giving notice of the to Ms. Clem, of course, and then we will at the next meeting follow up from there. So thank you all very much. Is there anything further?
Next meeting.
Next meeting is we have a special hearing next Thursday, 10 o'clock a.m. If I could ask the board members to come a little bit early, you know, 9:30, 9:45, so we can just make sure we're all on the same page about the process that we're going to be going forward with the hearing, which is In Re Jaron Price, assuming it hasn't negotiated its way out of a hearing by then. So thank you all very much. A very productive meeting, and it was great having the full complement physically present today. Thank you all very much. The time is now 12:54, and we are going off the record.